This Mormon organization killed Kennedy, and they did a lot of destruction, and they're out there.
There's a book called Treason for My Daily Bread, written by a guy named Mikhail Lebedev, which talks about the Mormon organization killing President Kennedy.
Exactly.
And there's also a book called Were We Controlled?
Exactly.
That talks about the Mormon organization and the killing of Kennedy.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Boris Johnson accused by former London Fire Chief of showing utter contempt for survivors and families of the 7/7 victims. Insisting they be shut out of any due legal process. So was Boris one of the main reasons there's still been no public inquiry into what really happened that day? Why we here on this programme have to continue to ask why the Israeli embassy's foreknowledge of what happened was supposed to be a surprise attack still hasn't been examined by the police or in court. And that's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to 7/7. Also, apparently, President Trump restrained himself yesterday from declaring war on Iran after a US drone was shot down. Just 6,000 miles that drone was from home. What was it doing there? And no thought of going to the United Nations Security Council for a mandate, of course. Putin warns that any act of war against Iran will get a response, which will make Trump sad. And a US-Israeli war with Iran will be catastrophic, says Putin. As the provocations against Iran continue, how long until the unthinkable happens? And vaccines. We take a look at some of the reasons people, particularly young mums, don't trust them. Is there any substance to the claims? And we hear an extract from the latest talk on measles by the so-called discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Finally, MH17, the Malaysian president, says there's zero evidence the Russians shot down his national airliner over the Ukraine in 2014. The Dutch inquiry, a NATO country, of course, they beg to differ. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at Tuesday at noon this week. An in-depth chat with John and Martin. You heard a bit of an extract from them earlier. Evicted from the bear pit this week under cover of operation to clear out spice dealers. And I talk about the British Borman book, Operation James Bond by John Ainsworth Davis. Up at the Save Redland Library campaign in April. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. Now, Martin, I think we should start with this peculiar situation with drones. Apparently an American drone got lost 6,000 miles away from America over the Straits of Hormuz yesterday.
Well, I mean, the Iranians claimed that it was in their airspace, and the Yanks claimed that it wasn't. So you've got two conflicting reports there.
So is it okay to shoot down a drone? Anyway,
if it's in your airspace, you're entitled to shoot it down.
The Americans were saying,
of course, if there are any rules, those are the rules.
They were about to do airstrikes against surface-to-air missile sites, several of them, and Trump was told, and he's admitted this now, he was told apparently about 120 people would die, so he decided he wouldn't do that.
Well, what happens, of course, if you kill 150 Iranians, they're likely to shoot back. This is what happened because of the chemical weapons attack at Douma last year turned out to be a fake, and then Britain fired British cruise missiles into Syria, and fortunately they took the view that they weren't going to fire back. They could have fired back. that have been in their rights to do so, wouldn't they? Especially since it was a fake attack.
Okay, so what about exactly what's going on over there now? Because we're told that there was a decision by Trump not to actually do the attack. Why no reference to the UN Security Council? You can't just go hitting a country.
Well, actual fact, there's no reference to the US Congress either. In actual fact, in the US Constitution, it's only the Congress that has the power to declare war. Now, what's happened is what they call the imperial presidency, is that over the years, the president has basically taken over that war declaring power, and nobody really pays any much attention to the rules anymore. Perhaps they ought to. I mean, what you're pointing out, what the rules are in this situation, but they are basically arguing on the basis that we don't care about the rules. We're just going to do what we want.
President Putin,
what we want
to do. He had his annual, it's a 4-hour press conference with members of the press from all over Russia and other parts of the world. I mean, including Ukraine. I noticed there were some Ukrainians in there too. He says a war between the United States and Iran would be a catastrophe. It would lead to an increase of violence and potential increase in refugees from the region, Putin said. It could have sad consequences for those who attempt it.
Well, I mean, that's common sense stuff, but we're teetering on the brink of this. Meanwhile, you know, as we stare at our own navels in Britain, you feel like asking the two candidates for Prime Minister, what is your view on World War III before we decide to, whether we're going to, we're not going to get to vote for them, but, you know, we're actually on the brink here of something happening. And nobody's paying much attention.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about this is these various things, it seems to be ramping up, doesn't it, in terms of the tankers. I think it was it five tankers initially attacked, only very lightly, and then we had two tankers last week, much bigger missile attacks. Interestingly, come to light, I mean, we didn't cover it on last week's show, the tanker attack of the Norwegian and the Japanese tankers, both of which were quite severely hit by, looks now like by missiles, that's what the crew on the Japanese ship said anyway, that actually the British SBS, Special Boat Service, were deployed to Oman, which is the part of the coast where it looks these missiles came from, that direction anyway, that's where the boats were hit, just 3 weeks before this attack. Who are the Special Boat Service, and what, is it possible they might have carried this attack out?
All right, two questions. The Special Boat Service are the Royal Marines version of the SAS, so they're more amphibious. And could they have carried out such an attack? Possibly, but I tend to think that what happens with these kind of false flag attacks is they try to create as much plausible deniability as possible, so that you wouldn't necessarily use a regular SBS unit to do it. People from that unit might be seconded to do it, but they wouldn't do it as an SBS unit as such. That would be my guess, but I'm only guessing.
Well, one of the things that's also come out because of this attack, at least it's been revealed in the Daily Express, is Iran's top secret weapon, which will stop any US invasion attempt in its tracks. Iran has a weapon that could be potentially catastrophic for the US, using that same word as Putin used, should conflict break out between the two countries, an expert has stated. The weapon is, in fact, an electromagnetic pulse weapon. Tensions between Iran and the US have neared breaking point over the last few weeks. This electromagnetic pulse weapon, Martin, would leave all the US troops, according to this Daily Express article, unable to even communicate. They would knock out planes. Planes would just simply fall out of the sky. What is this weapon?
Well, if you remember, the USS Donald Cook was in the Black Sea about 2 years ago now. And the Russians, it was in a part of the sea that the Russians didn't want it to be in their territorial waters. So they flew missions at it. They knocked out all of its electronics. It's basically a spy ship. So they knocked out all of the electronics, and then they ran various dummy bombing runs at it just to show what they could do. If it comes to a shooting war in the Gulf, a full-on shooting war, both sides are going to deploy all sorts of stuff. And I wouldn't claim to be an expert on all of this.
Okay, writing in the American Spectator, geopolitical analyst Brandon J. Vexert said Iran has devastating electromagnetic pulse weapons which could be devastating for the US. Could incapacitate the technological US invasion force before they could even damage Iran.
Well, if you think about it, if you're a smaller player like Iran taking on a technologically superior enemy like the US, then you go after their electronics. That's the weak point, isn't it? You try and make sure that you don't rely upon electronics, because they do, and if you can knock their electronics out, then they're fighting blind and you're not.
Way back in 2014, I interviewed a guy from Cheltenham, a scientist, Norman Ellis, who's written, apparently, the book on electromagnetic pulses. It's called The Electrical Interference Handbook. Norman died in just after I interviewed him, actually, in Prestbury, just on the outskirts of Cheltenham, with this rather peculiar chap who lived next door to him, who sort of seemed to be spying on us as we were going in and out of the house. But anyway, this is what Norman had to say about these electromagnetic pulse weapons.
If you happen to let it off at 35k above the Earth's surface...
Well, that's 35,000 feet, yeah.
Yes, sorry. It generates an enormous electrical field in the air due to the molecules washing about, if you like, as the explosion occurs. And this field is so enormous that it can damage things like television sets. It'll do it over a radius of up to about 1,000 miles from the center of impact. Now, when the explosion occurs at that height, you're unlikely to hear very much. You won't suffer from a blast effect. You might see a twinkle in the sky, but that's about it. But the major effect will be electronic. And for modern defense systems used by the Army, Navy and Air Force, of course they rely on communications. Now, if that event happened there, unless they use protected equipment, then they could be damaged, and therefore they lose the capability of communication.
That's not the only thing that gets knocked out, is it, Martin? Everything pretty much would grind to a halt. Cars, things like that. This studio, I don't think anything would work if there was an electromagnetic pulse weapon used.
Well, I understand.
Within 1,000 miles of us, Norman is saying.
I understand that the Russians have very definitely developed this sort of stuff. I've no idea how you'd deploy it, because, of course, if you did something like that, you'd possibly destroy your own electronic communications. So if you were going to use it, you'd have to find some way of either protecting your own electronic communications or communicating
non-electronically. But, I mean, well, I suppose what the Iranians are thinking is, well, you're way, way away from your country. You're 6,000 miles away from America, and this is our territory, and if we want to set this off, we will, and that will leave your boats just sitting in the water, your airplanes just gliding. They'll become gliders, won't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, and if you're going to use
such a control
weapon, I would argue that you've got to be prepared that you're prepared to fight on after such a thing has happened.
I mean, would it
you've
be,
got to be
would
able be, to either protect your own electronics by, you know, using some casings or something like that, or you just rely, I mean, before electronic warfare, people used to just rely upon, you know, sophomore.
I mean, would
a B-52
bomber just slowly start to become a glider as all the engines switch off and then go into a spiral dive with a nuclear bomb on it?
Well, presumably that's exactly the effect that you're looking for, isn't it? I mean, the problem with high tech is it's high tech. I mean, the Iraqi resistance worked this out years ago, and they basically went very, very low tech. Don't use mobile phones. They used these 5-volt batteries to set off the bombs, which all this expensive electronic warfare equipment can't detect. And they relied upon whispering to people and writing things down on bits of cigarette paper and swallowing them afterwards. And that's how you do it if you're fighting a high tech enemy, because they can't do that stuff.
How long until the unthinkable happens with Iran, Martin? Because it does seem as if in this last year of Donald Trump's presidency, there is some sort of determination to actually kick something off.
Well, I think Bolton and Pompeo and all those lot are definitely keen for something to happen.
Who are the various forces involved here?
Well, I mean, inside the US administration, you've got a very strong hawkish faction. And Trump has got one foot in their camp. And he's also got another foot in the other camp, because, of course, if it all goes horribly wrong, he will get the blame. And he's not very keen on that. And it looks like he has basically decided, you know, I mean, we're all dependent upon what goes on in his brain cells.
I mean, if those several...
This is a scary thought.
If those several surface-to-air missile batteries had been destroyed yesterday, what would be the consequences today?
Well, what the Iranians could easily do is say, you do that to us, that's an act of war. First thing we're going to do is sink all your ships in the Gulf. We're going to sink them all. I mean, this is what could have happened last year with Britain firing cruise missiles based in Akrotiri at the Syrians. The Syrians chose to suck it up, but they could have decided to fire back and basically kill as many people as they possibly could at RAF Akrotiri. And then, of course, the British government's face, oh, we've lost 200 of our people. Yes, but you started the war. The other side aren't always going to take the view that we're not going to fire back. And of course, what may happen at a certain point is Soleimani or some of the more hardline generals in the Iranian side are going to say, right, we've had enough now. It's time to punch them on the nose. Bullies never back down until you punch them on the nose. Let's punch them on the nose. And of course, that means lots of blood.
Another actor involved here, of course, is Israel. Israel's secretive nuclear facility leaking as Watchdog finds Israel has nearly 100 nuclear weapons. Israel is one of only five nations in the world that refused to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, an international treaty aimed at ending the proliferation of nuclear weapons and achieving global nuclear disarmament. So apparently the Israelis have got twice as many nukes as was first thought, 100 of them.
Well, I was under the understanding they had 200, but it doesn't really make much difference. It's enough to make an awful big bang.
Well, Colin Powell apparently said 200 years ago, but lots of people denied that.
Well, I mean, the fact is the Israelis have got nuclear weapons. They're not supposed to have them. They basically stole the material from the Americans, which is why Jonathan Pollard was sent to prison in the US as a spy, because he'd sold them the material. And the plans and everything, they're not supposed to have them. Under the Logan Act, any country that develops nuclear weapons illegally should be put under immediate sanctions by the US. So that's why the Israelis won't admit that they've got them directly, because if they do, the Logan Act would possibly kick in, which means they've got to be put under full sanctions like North Korea or somewhere like that. I mean, Israel is a rogue state, and Martin von Krevelt, who's a sort of defence intellectual over there, wrote, you know, he said some years ago, what the Western powers have got to understand is that we have got nuclear weapons, and if they try and push us around, we can hit Rome, we can hit Berlin, we can hit Paris. That's what he's threatening.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU settlement scheme. This means that the rights you currently have will be protected after the UK leaves the EU. The scheme is fully open, and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU settlement scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
We'll be talking about the Israel's role in 7-7 in a minute, or at least alleged role. But first, in the Conservative leader debate at the BBC on Wednesday, which, by the way, was a bit shambolic. I don't know if you saw it, Martin, but there was lots and lots of people talking over each other. And
gosh,
I think the BBC might be talking about eventually sacking the producer of that programme, because it wasn't sort of carved out properly so that each person had an opportunity to say something. It was a kind of free for all. But anyway, the point being here on this topic is that the Bristol contingent put in a question to the debate about Islamophobia, and that's about 4.5 minutes long, the answers. Quite complicated and excellent question, and let's have a listen to that and their answers, the various candidates' answers. Now, obviously, we're mostly interested in the answers of Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt.
We've got Abdullah waiting for us in Bristol. Evening, Abdullah. What's your question for the panel here?
Evening, Emily. Evening, gentlemen. I'm the imam of a mosque, and I see firsthand the everyday impact of Islamophobic rhetoric on my community. Do the candidates agree that words have consequences?
So the candidates agree that words have consequences. Boris Johnson, in the past you've said Muslim women who wear veils look like letterboxes and bank robbers. Do you accept your words have consequences? You've just heard that from an imam.
Of course. And insofar as my words have given offence over the last 20 or 30 years when I've been a journalist, and people have taken those words out of my articles and escalated them, of course I'm sorry for the offence that they have caused. But I would just say this, to our friend from Bristol that when my Muslim great-grandfather came to this country in fear of his life in 1912, he did so because he knew it was a place that was a beacon of generosity and openness and a willingness to welcome people from around the world. And
if I am Prime Minister,
I will ensure that that is the way our country acts and behaves. And I may say that in respect of what my friend over there says, you know,
Abdullah.
I think my Muslim great-grandfather would have been astonished to have found that his great-grandson had become foreign secretary.
The question was, though, do you accept that words have consequences?
But he would have been very proud, and that would have been, I think, a tribute to this country.
Mr. Johnson, do you accept that words have consequences? You are frequently careless with your language. Do you worry that you may do more harm than good? I'm going to raise the issue of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, and this was your comment. When I look at what Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe was doing, she was simply teaching people journalism, as I understand it. You know what that did to her jail sentence in a Tehran jail.
Well, actually, I think it's very, very important, Emily, that in this context we should pay tribute to the work of the Foreign Office in doing what they can
to get out
very difficult consular cases. But in seeking to point the finger either at me or at anybody in the UK for the incarceration of Nazanin or anybody else, we have a deepest sympathy, clearly, for Nazanin and her family. But in pointing the finger at our
words
side,
have consequences. That was Abdullah's phrase.
At our side, well, actually, in that case, it didn't, I think, make any difference. But in our, if you point the finger at the UK, all you are doing is exculpating those who are truly responsible,
so,
which is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard.
And when Donald Trump,
that is the reality. And people should realise what this regime is up to.
Okay,
and
I'm going to ask
that is where
the question to Jeremy Hunt. When Donald Trump retweets offensive, irascible comments about Londonistan, you say you don't like the language, but basically you agree 150% with the content of the tweet.
No. What I said was I agreed with his sentiment that Sadiq Khan has been a useless London mayor when it comes to tackling knife crime, but I totally disagree with his words and I totally disagree with the racist rants of Katie Hopkins. And let me tell you why. I am married to an immigrant. I have three half-Chinese children. When they go to school, they look different to the other kids. And you know, the best thing about this country is it doesn't matter at all. Nobody says anything. We are one of the most open, outward-looking, tolerant countries on the planet. And we must do everything we can to preserve and protect that, particularly at the point of Brexit, where people worry that, I think wrongly, but they worry that somehow our culture might change. And I think we have to show people the Brexit that the Conservatives are going to deliver is a tolerant Brexit. We're not going to put the shutters down and say foreigners not welcome. We're going to remain that brilliant, welcoming country.
Sajid Javid, you've said you'd be happy to open up the Conservative Party to an independent investigation over allegations of Islamophobia. Would you like everyone on the stage who becomes our next Prime Minister, anyone, to commit to that?
Yes, I would. Do you all agree, guys? Should we have an external investigation of the Conservative Party into Islamophobia?
Absolutely.
They all agree. Rory, do you agree? Excellent.
So,
they agree.
So that was Sajid Javid's comment on that particular item, Martin. But Boris is blaming the Iranian Revolutionary Guard for his comments about Muslims.
Well, he's just trying to evade the question. I mean, but basically the question I was saying, the perception that you speak first and think later. And, of course, he's just trying to evade the question that she's asked him. And, of course, he basically let the cat out of the bag that the woman in Iran was, in fact, training journalists when she was supposed to be there on a tourist visa. And, therefore, from the Iranian point of view, she's acting in a hostile fashion.
Well, I'm also joined by the former press officer a former press officer for South Yorkshire Police, Tony Farrell. Hi, Tony. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. I wasn't the press officer. I was the principal intelligence analyst.
Principal intelligence analyst.
At
okay.
South Yorkshire Police.
could you give us your thoughts on this Tory leadership and also potentially, anyway, an investigation into Islamophobia in the Conservative Party? I know you've converted to Islam. Have you? When did you do that?
No.
You haven't. Right. All right.
No.
Okay.
Long story.
So, two facts wrong in the first.
Not too bad.
But I've been away for a long time.
Just by your appearance, you've got a great long beard and you've got a nice little sort of hat on. So that's nothing to do with your.
No, it gets me. This changed appearance gets me arrested in Gibraltar on National Day, when so it's thousands of people dressed in red in the main square. And I look like a Mad Muller.
Is it a sort of disguise?
You look like something from Glastonbury.
Is it a disguise?
No, it's not a disguise, no.
You're just doing it for fun, okay. All right, so, yeah, what's your thoughts on what you've just heard anyway there?
Well, don't we think that it's rich coming from Boris, the master of spin? It's simply just not cricket. He's got words do count, and Boris has a habit of putting his foot in things. I can think of what he did in 2004 with The Spectator, when he lambasted Liverpudlians and mentioned Hillsborough.
So what did he just remind us about that? I mean, I certainly didn't know about it. What did he say?
He said, in talking about Liverpudlians in The Spectator, he said they see themselves whenever possible as victims and resent their victim status. He's talking about the Liverpudlians and the Hillsborough families who are pursuing justice, yet at this same time they wallow in it and describe it as a psychological state in Liverpool, which he subsequently had to go to Liverpool twice in order to profusely apologise for his inappropriate words.
Anyway, this Abdullah, this imam who gave this question on the BBC leadership debate, Mr. Patel, he was criticised after for tweets from the past where he said every political figure, Martin, on the Zionist payroll is scaring the world about Corbyn. Now, is that an anti-Semitic tweet?
I wouldn't argue so. Some would say, but I wouldn't say. I would say that's fair comment. I mean, basically, we know that the Israeli embassy operates in a very active way in this country. We got the Al Jazeera sting where the Mossad officer said on camera, we've got £1 million to spend in the Labour Party to get the results we want. And then people say it's anti-Semitic to say that. That's just the facts, that
is. He also shared an image endorsing the relocation of Israel to the United States as a way of solving the Israel-Palestine conflict.
What that is a gif that went round on the internet saying, you know, we could put Israel in the middle of the United... You know, if the Christian Zionists want Israel to, the Israelis to have a state, they can have one in South Dakota. And in other words, this is all, what we're dealing with here is people being very sensitive about all of these things, when in actual fact we need to be more robust about all of these things. And, it's the sort of thing they're going to say, but it's wrong.
Tony, I know you've been quite outspoken about the 7/7 London bombings over the years, and we've heard just this week, since we're looking at Boris, that he has being extremely rude and condemnatory of the this is allegedly anyway by the former London fire chief of the I can't use the words on air that he's supposed to have used against them to criticise them for the victims and the families of the 7/7 London bombings, basically saying that there shouldn't be public money spent on legal cases which look into the actual causes. What are your thoughts about what Boris has said there?
Well, first of all, has he really said that? We haven't actually got him to make a confession that he has said it.
He hasn't confessed, but no. The former London fire chief who was in meetings with him at
Brian
the time,
Coleman.
That's what he said in last weekend's Daily Mirror.
So if we take that as true, then it's... One, it was foul-mouthed to Rad that he actually spoke on the inquest, and as you're right, it's unrepeatable on air. He has got form previously for 7/7. In 2014, on the very same day that those abominable monuments, the 52 steel girders that are in Hyde Park, they were daubed with the truth. Blair lied, thousands died.
When you say the truth, what do you mean by that? And what was said?
Well, those monuments were daubed hours before the ceremony that was supposed, the memorial service was to be taken place. And at the time, Boris was the Mayor of London. So he spoke out in condemnation. He said, I'm shocked and saddened by this incident. It is completely unacceptable. And the Metropolitan Police is already investigating. I am pleased that the graffiti, as he called it, was removed so quickly, and that today's commemoration ceremony can go ahead as planned. This is when all 52 girders were daubed with meaningful graffiti talking about elements of the truth of how 7-7 was an inside job and that the rationale for going to war overseas. And that was done as a protest, and that instead of addressing the issues of why that was done, he just condemned it and tried to relate it as this is an appalling action for the families who've suffered, when the families have suffered, because of a lie, and a lie that continues.
So it was the Sunday Mirror. Boris Johnson ranted F the families. That's during 7-7 bombing victims' insult. Boris Johnson's alleged outburst came when he was Mayor of London and being briefed about the cost of inquests into the 2005 London terror attacks, which killed 52 people. So he was annoyed about the cost of the inquest. So he said F the families, allegedly. Yeah. Now, the outburst came when he was Mayor of London and being briefed about the cost of inquests. Brian Coleman, who was chair of the London Fire and Emergency Planning Authority, claims Mr. Johnson erupted in fury and said F the families twice. A second source told the Sunday Mirror he was certain Boris used the offensive words. Another source at the meeting, though, disputed Mr. Coleman's account. So there is at least some disputation of that. Interesting comments, Martin, particularly because actually a public inquiry was what the family wanted, not an inquest. An inquest is designed to investigate a single suspicious death on its own, and a public inquiry is where a group of people, a small group or whatever, die. Say, for example, if there's a train crash or something, you'll have a public inquiry. Actually, the appropriate legal procedure is a public inquiry for something like 7-7, and yet that didn't happen.
Well, wasn't it Tony Blair who said it would be a ludicrous diversion to have such an inquiry? And of course, since we're not going to have a trial because all four supposed perpetrators are dead, then we don't get to investigate what happened at all. And of course, the real context for all of this is NATO intelligence services promotion of terrorism going back decades, the Gladio networks going back to the 1940s.
I mean, some people,
in the 1980s.
Some people have actually made films, as you mentioned there. The Ludicrous Diversion came out, I think it was the second film that came out. There was one by somebody called BT Anonymous that just put together lots of bits of questionable evidence about 7-7. Yeah. And then Ludicrous Diversion came out, which was actually a very high quality, like literally network television quality documentary, which of course was never broadcast. And I suppose that's the point of these things, that somebody out there is making a documentary, but the national TV networks just refuse to broadcast these things.
Well, indeed, and there's also Mind the Gap, which was one of the things that we were involved in making. And lots of people were asking questions about this, and there's plenty of questions to ask.
In fact, one of the most important points, I think, that the Ludicrous Diversion film makes, it makes thousands, and I'll put a link up to that on our show page too, because it's still out there, is that we've had the Guildford 4 and the Birmingham 6 cases, where it was an absolutely massive miscarriage of justice. And so there's no reason to believe that something like that couldn't happen with the 7-7 case too.
Well, indeed, but I think it's even more, the miscarriage of justice in those two cases was that random Irish people were rounded up, even though the IRA admitted that they'd carried out both attacks. Whereas the 7-7 attacks are part of what we might call a more sophisticated, in my view, a more sophisticated psychological warfare operation led from inside the intelligence services. And of course, you know, there's plenty of other things that have gone on. That was just what happened here in this country. It was bad enough, but of course, you've got the 9/11 attacks in the US, the Bologna bombing in 1980 in Italy, which killed 87 people, and if you're talking about the Irish connection, it's the bombs in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, which the Garda are pretty convinced were carried out by MI5 via the Grenade.
I mean, are there any other things to do with the 7-7 bombings that you think worthy of note? Because, you know, if Boris is not interested in getting to the bottom of it for the families of those that have died, it's rather worrying to think that he could become Prime Minister.
Well, I'll mention just two things. I mean, obviously, there's lots of people have made films about this, but the first thing is that the Israeli embassy had a warning that there was going to be an attack. Benjamin Netanyahu was in the embassy that morning. He was supposed to go to a meeting. He was a finance minister. He was supposed to go to a meeting at Liverpool Street. Jerusalem Post phoned up.
I don't think he was in the actual embassy. He was in a hotel.
Yeah, he was in a hotel near the embassy, but he didn't. And Jerusalem Post phoned up the embassy. Is Bibi all right? He said, no, he's fine, because we got a warning. And they actually said that on air in Israel.
And also they put it out on the Associated Press, right. Newswire.
And he definitely didn't go to the meeting. And the second thing I'd mention... Yeah,
I'll just add to that, right, because I spoke to the guy from the Sunday Herald, Glasgow Herald, who said that he'd also spoken to the press officers at the Israeli embassy, and they said actually they went on to high security lockdown around about 7:45 that morning. So that was well over an hour before the bombs actually went off. The Israeli embassy were on a high security alert for a bomb attack. Now, this is supposed to be a surprise attack.
Well, that's what I think is what Sherlock Holmes used to call a clue, isn't it? The other thing which is, I think, devastating is that through investigations carried out by independent investigators who we know, Connex Rail eventually admitted that the trains that the bombers supposedly caught that morning didn't run. Now, if the trains didn't run, they couldn't possibly have been in the times and places that the official story suggests. And of course, people think they've seen video footage of the bombers, but that was the previous week. It wasn't actually on the day itself. In other words, if the trains didn't run, the story won't stand up. And of course, ultimately, people who drink in pubs in West Belfast.
Well, it just means they got. It doesn't mean anything. It just means they got a different train.
No, but they couldn't possibly have been in the times and places where the bombs went off. In that case, there was supposedly a timeline that showed exactly where they were and exactly where they went.
Anyway, Tony,
of course, other people said that bombs were under the trains. Loads of people said the bombs weren't.
Tony, I know the films you like is also one of these films that was made just after, and it was also sent, I think, to some of the people, some of the jury who were on a court case. But that actually, of course, is a criminal offence, trying to interfere with a jury.
Well, that's an interesting point, Tony. We're talking here about the Hillsborough Ripple Effect film by Moid Deeb, and he created that in 2007.
It's 7-7 Ripple Effect.
7-7, sorry, I beg your pardon, 7-7 Ripple Effect. He created that in 2007. He sent it to a trial of three associates, supposedly, of the four bombers that didn't do it. And he did that in an attempt to prevent a perversion of the course of justice. He was then subjected to extradition from Ireland, where he faced a trial. He sent it to the Kingston trial, the clerk of the court. He did everything proper in what he called an amicus curiae brief. He then spent 157 days in prison, that coincided with the Lady Justice Hallett inquiry. One of the reasons why Hillsborough Ripple Effect...
So hang on, this is
the 7-7 Ripple Effect...
This is the inquest you're talking about that has
to coincide. His imprisonment for the trial at Suffolk coincided with the duration of the Lady Justice Hallett's Hillsborough...
7-7
inquest.
Yeah.
And then he went to trial, and the prosecution played it before the jury. It was the prosecution, not the defence, played the 7-7 Ripple Effect to the jury, and the jury were, by a 10-2 majority, cleared Moad Deeb for the perversion of the course of justice. And what's interesting here, I think, is your former employers, Tony, the BBC, produced a BBC Conspiracy Files programme that set out to ridicule Moad Deeb for what he did with that particular DVD, that documentary.
But that was before the result of this case, which had exonerated him.
Yes, but they scarcely got a mention, and it was deathly silent.
You seem to be channeling Hillsborough here somehow, so I think I better let you talk about Hillsborough as well, because I know you were very much involved in that at the time up in South Yorkshire Police, and also were at the Duckenfield trial. So can you just bring us up to date with that?
Yeah. My very first interview, you'll recall, Tony, with yourself, I did 15 minutes on Walter Jackson in the control room, gibbering like a wreck, and you covered that. And what subsequently, over a prolonged period, we eventually got the CPS decision-making, where six people were originally charged for offences, only six, the main one being the manslaughter for gross negligence that was levelled against David Duckenfield, the match commander on the day, the match commander that was brought in at the 11th hour, and the match commander that didn't really know the correct name of Nottingham Forest, the football club that was in the semi-final at Hillsborough. Such was his lack of knowledge about Hillsborough. He was, we believe, brought in as the useful idiot. And we made a film, Royal Indeed made another film, which is what I've twice made reference to, the Hillsborough Ripple Effect film, which presents an alternative hypothesis about it being not an accident that went tragically wrong, but a deliberately planned event that, as we all know, the circumstances have all been covered up for the last 30 years. But if we bring ourselves back to Preston and the recent trial with Duckenfield, what we find has happened is that the jury, the Duckenfield didn't even have to stand in the witness box to make his own defence. The charges against him and the evidence against him was probably insufficient, and the state always knew that that was likely to happen. The jury couldn't reach a decision, so there is a possibility of a retrial in September alongside two other police officers who were associated with the changing and alteration of statements.
Okay, well, I mean, this is perversion of the course of justice, perversion, absolutely right. If you're changing someone's statement, etc., and that's been proved to have happened at Hillsborough, I mean, this is seems like a British disease we've got here. What hope is there for people, the Grenfell Tower inquiry, when it's taken such a long time for the Hillsborough families, victims, and they haven't even had justice yet?
I'm very pessimistic about any kind of outcome on Grenfell. I'm very pessimistic. The people of Hillsborough who've suffered for the last 30 years have been very vocal in trying to get behind the Grenfell victims and supporters in the hope that they won't have to suffer the same. But the issue, I think, is that even with those family supporters that are actually asking for justice from Hillsborough onto Grenfell, they have the Hillsborough people haven't had the truth yet, and they haven't had justice. Well, no, but no police officer has ever been brought to justice. There's a hope, a vague hope in September that two will be prosecuted. The only conviction so far is Graham Mackerel, and when we think about the millions that have been spent over 30 years, all that Mackerel was convicted of was something that constituted a fine of £6,500, and when you compare that with the millions that have been spent on legal team,
what did he do?
He was the football secretary of Sheffield Wednesday, and he was negligent on issues of ground safety.
Okay, the Tory behind the Grenfell revamp, switching to the Grenfell story there, hopefully not too untidily, has hosted a lavish party just before, weeks before the anniversary of the fire. Rock Hugo Basil Fielding Mellon. And I know the people in Portobello Road call him something else, which rhymes with rock, but it's not. And it's that, so their word, rock wielding felon, that's what they call him. He's oversaw Grenfell's refurbishment, but he invited actress Rosamund Pike and John Lennon's musician son Sean to his 40th bash. The Tory councillor who oversaw the refurbishment and signed off this, in fact put pressure on for the decision to change the cladding, has been slammed for throwing a star-studded party at his family's country pile weeks before the horror's two-year anniversary. His 40th birthday bash saw a who's who of socialites and stars descend on Stanway House in Gloucestershire, including actress Rosamund Pike and John Lennon's musician son Sean. Photos on social media showed millionaires rubbing shoulders with his mum's 5,000-acre Jacobean mansion as families prepared themselves to commemorate the tragedy that killed 72. Grenfell United, the survivors and bereaved families group, said seeing these pictures is like a gut punch. Martin Summers.
Well, it's not exactly brilliant PR from his point of view, is it?
And well, it was an exclusive in the Mirror, and nobody else really seems to have covered this but the Mirror.
Well, I mean, the Pat Finucane Centre in Northern Ireland has always said that British inquiries are not acceptable. because basically the British inquiries are controlled by the executive. They always were pretty much a whitewash, but changes in the law quite recently have made them even more so. And they continue to push for a full inquiry into collusion between the army and police and the loyalist paramilitaries in Northern Ireland. But they want an international inquiry. They want international judges, you know, Canadians, Finns, etc. The British system is broken. It's quite clear that the inquiry system is basically a farce. So they, even when they order an inquiry, they don't actually get to the bottom of it because they're not actually empowered to do anything much, and they're there to cover it all up.
Moving on to MH17, the Malaysian President Martin saying there's no evidence the Russians shot down his national airliner over Ukraine in 2014. However, the Dutch inquiry is saying it was the Russians, and they've been putting out more so-called evidence this week. So this is Holland is a NATO country, and effectively it's the military who are taking a lot of influence over this inquiry. So that does suggest that this is a NATO inquiry. How come the Malaysians have been shut out of an inquiry into the crash of their own airliner with their own nationals on board?
You may well ask, Tony, and of course this is presented to the general population of, you know, the Dutch would be the people to investigate this, and they say this. In actual fact, there is actually a procedure that should be followed in cases like this, and the Malaysians should definitely have been included in the team to investigate, but they were excluded because Malaysia is a very bad country. They don't do the things that they're supposed to do. Mahathir Mohamad pointed the finger and said 9/11 was an inside job. He was the Prime Minister of Malaysia, and also in 1998 the Malaysians brought in exchange controls when they had an economic crisis, which actually worked and prevented rich people taking their money out of the country. But that was another blot on their copybook, because if they can do that, and everybody else is going to start doing it, maybe we're going to do it.
The plane crash inquiry team has announced murder charges against four men. The Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad has condemned the decision as ridiculous. The three Russians and a Ukrainian are accused of bringing a missile into eastern Ukraine. Now, if you just compare this to say if this was a British Airways plane and an inquiry had been done into a British Airways plane that had been flying into London somewhere else in the world, and then the British Prime Minister said, we think that the charges are ridiculous, this all starts to sound as if there's an attempt to get the Malaysians here by NATO.
If it was an inside job by NATO intelligence services, which is what I believe to be the case, then some plane has to be shot down. And the plane you choose to shoot down will be the Malaysian plane.
We know Andriy Perebi, who was the National Security Council of Ukraine's chair, stepped down 3 weeks afterwards without explaining why, didn't he?
Well,
plane crash.
I don't know how much time we've got to go into the MH17 issue, but I mean the basic problem, I'll try and summarise as quickly as I can. The basic problem is that there's no reason for the Russians to bring a Buk missile into East Ukraine. Don't forget they were being bombed, but they were being bombed from low level, so they were fighting back with manpads, just handheld stuff. They don't really need something to shoot something down at 30,000 feet.
Theresa May has,
in fact, the Ukrainians had 7 Buk missile batteries in place to stop Russians bringing in,
and also the pilot of the Sukhoi plane, which is alleged to have shot it down. The footage, of course, was taken down from the BBC Russian service
website.
Interviewed
people on the ground who said we saw a plane shoot it down,
and footage was then removed by the BBC. Yeah. But he committed suicide last year. The pilot of the plane, which may have shot it down, the fighter, which of course it makes that investigation into that much more difficult. But anyway, with all these tensions ramping up, we had something that Theresa May has never done. Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, on TV yesterday, live around the world, apart from of course here, he was doing a press conference, and he talked here about the withdrawal of the United States from the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which of course has an enormous influence on the nuclear weapons and limits those in Europe, and arguably the Americans withdrawing from this actually makes a nuclear war in Europe more likely.
After the United States withdrew from the relevant treaty, this treaty that was the cornerstone when it comes to non-proliferation and putting an end to an arms race, we had to respond with creating a new type of weapon to overcome this anti-missile defense systems. And now we hear that Russia has an advantage when it comes to weaponry systems. Of course, course, other countries in the world do not possess such systems, but they are going to develop such systems, and this does provide us with a certain advantage. But this, this is about having equal conditions, having the parity when it comes to our weapon arsenals. Now they're making another step, and they are withdrawing from the INF treaty. So what's going to come out of that? It's hard to imagine what is going to happen next. If those missiles would be positioned in Europe, what are we going to do? We will need to ensure that we are safe. And then they would be complaining that we have an advantage. We are not striving to have an advantage. We are striving to keep a proper balance, ensure our security. The same goes for the new START treaty. It expires in 2021. We do not have any negotiations in place as of yet, so you're not interested in that. You don't want to keep that. That's okay. We can ensure our safety. We know how to do that. But for humanity in general, this is a bad thing because it leads us to a very risky verge. There's a trend to lower this threshold of actually using those weapons. They want to make small-scale nuclear weapons in order to use them tactically. Some analysts are already expressing such ideas that maybe perhaps it's not such a bad thing and we can use it, but lowering the threshold might lead to a global nuclear catastrophe.
So that's Russian President Vladimir Putin in his annual press conference, four-hour marathon, speaking yesterday, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can imagine some of our people having to have a press conference for 4 hours with no notes.
The interesting thing is, I mean, it goes all over the place, so there's no attempt. Actually, it was much more organised than our leadership debate, that's for sure, because there's only one person it's focused on. Yeah. But it would go from lots of little local stories onto these big ones effortlessly.
Well, the point he's making is absolutely clear. You know, if you start making small nukes, which is what the West has been doing, because they say it's only a little one, and the Russian strategic doctrine is that we're not using nuclear weapons, and if we do use them, we're going to use them all out and we're just going to annihilate you. And these people have just lost the plot, because they just have. They like spending money on for the sake of it.
Well, I mean, isn't this whole idea of pulling out of the START treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces treaty, this is just a boondoggle for the arms industry?
It is, and also, of course, what the thing is that they want to use short range nuclear weapons against the Chinese, and they can't do that as long as the INF treaty works in Europe. So they're getting out the European treaty, so they can then deploy similar stuff in Southeast Asia.
Well, I said we were going to be talking about vaccines. I think we're going to have to do that next week. It's too big a subject to try and cram in as well. Because, Tony, I want to let you, since you're here, talk a bit about Gibraltar, where you are now.
Yeah, well, with all the trouble and strife in Britain, I'm kind of glad I'm going to be back on the plane shortly, going back to Gibraltar. But we're talking about the Russians, and I just want to sort of make one sort of point that's been in the recent news about Gibraltar, and that it's to do with Spain refuels Russian ships despite NATO pressure. And that happened as recently as the 18th of June. And it's kind of Spain exerting pressure on the British about Gibraltar and the sovereignty of Gibraltar. And Madrid complains about the British in their military presence. But what we're talking about here is a Russian patrol ship called the Vasily Baikov at the Russian Navy. It's docked at the port of Ceuta, a Spanish enclave, and the refueling suggests that the Spanish authorities are far more comfortable with Russian military presence than they are with colonial
Britain. I'll tell you what it also suggests is that NATO is starting to break up a bit, Martin. We've heard the Turks are actually taking all sorts of different types of weapons. They're still sitting around the NATO table, but one wonders whether their heart is really in it.
Well, they've said that they're going to take the SS-400s from the Russians, and the Americans have said we'll have to leave NATO, and the Turks are saying, well, maybe we'll have to leave NATO. And don't forget, there was a military coup attempted against Erdogan couple of years ago, and as far as he's concerned, that was NATO trying to get rid of him. And NATO is breaking up, because it's basically a fan club for the United States, and the United States is told what to do.
I mean, most of the countries, of course, in it.
Most
of the countries in it, of course, are in Europe, and most of those European countries don't really want a nuclear war fought on their soil by America.
They don't know. And of course, at the minute, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is nearly finished, bringing gas from Siberia to Germany. And the Americans are saying, no, it'll have to be cancelled. And the Germans are saying, hang on a minute, we've spent millions on this, and it's our decision. But the Americans are trying to stop them. These tensions are as high as they've been since World War II. So we're actually moving to what the international relations specialists call it's a moment of shifting hegemony. Yeah, where basically the kaleidoscope's going to shift and lots of different countries are going to jump in different directions.
Okay.
Very dangerous.
Okay, so time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, former leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, it's Councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus. Also thanks to Tony Farrell, intelligence analyst at South Yorkshire Police. You'll find this show's podcast story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. We'll have a good old look at vaccines next week. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Is wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend with Billy Quain's Saturday edition at 10 a.m. and Bristol's Best Kept Musical Secrets Sunday evenings at 7 with Danny Lopsch. Our sister show Dialects here next Tuesday. We will be hearing from the Bear Pit residents at noon next Tuesday. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. I'll leave you with a song from Martin Cosgrave Martian, whose funeral is next Tuesday in London. This song is Drug Abuse Is Not a Crime from 2002. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Despite our best efforts, shortages of marijuana are now being reported. message for hours. Despite our best efforts, shortages of marijuana are now being reported. From the early days of our administration, Nancy has been using marijuana on a daily basis, and her personal observations and efforts have given her such dramatic insights that I wanted her to share them with you this evening.
I yearn to find a way to help share the message that drugs open your eyes to life, to see it in the vivid colors that God gave us.
And drug abuse is not a crime. And in the most important area, individual use, we see progress. The U.S. military has more than tripled the use of drugs among its personnel since 1980. And there's one more thing. Nancy and I are hooked on heroin. Our goal is to expand drug trafficking at all levels of government and in the private sector. Help us.
Sounds like it's having a hallucinogenic effect, not like a drug which is harmful and wrong and just say no, kids, but spacey nonetheless. Just say no, kids. Just say no, kids. Just say no, kids.
I yearn to find a way to help share the message that drugs open your eyes to life. see it in the vivid colors that God gave us.
Sounds like it's having an hallucinogenic effect.
Is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2 online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour.